Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. This episode features talks by Anne Wright and Ray McGovern, recorded at the 20th Annual Kateri Peace Conference, held August 18, 2018 in Fonda, New York. Anne Wright is a retired diplomat and Army Reserve Colonel who resigned from the Department of State in 2003 in opposition to the Iraq War. Ray McGovern served as a CIA analyst for 27 years, from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. In January 2003, Ray co-founded Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose how intelligence was being falsified to provide a pretext for war on Iraq. Among other topics covered at the Kateri Peace Conference, Anne Wright and Ray McGovern spoke about the Gaza Freedom Flotillas and Russiagate. You can find Other Voices, Other Choices on iTunes and YouTube. And now, Anne Wright.
It's a very powerful trip to be able to go to Afghanistan and meet with young women and men of Afghanistan that are trying desperately in a place where war is the main thing, and the U.S. still being involved in it 17 years after October of 2001, when the very first U.S. troops arrived in Afghanistan. And if we think about the horrors of what has happened, the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who've been killed in Afghanistan, Afghans primarily, some U.S., some from other countries that have been dragged into the NATO war in Afghanistan. If you think of just this last week of what's happened, where there have been two major horrific losses of life, where ISIS has now claimed that they are responsible for killing over 60 young Afghans who had gathered at a university to work on preparing for university entrance exams. And then you think about the police stations that the Taliban has said that they're responsible for killing, I think it was something like 40 Afghan police last week, and suicide bombers. So Afghanistan is, of course, one of the places that I think we have all been calling for the end of the U.S. war on Afghanistan. Nobody can predict really what will happen if the U.S. pulls out. We do know that at least it's not Americans killing Afghans. The U.S. Military using assassin drones in Afghanistan still goes on. And if you look at the numbers of American troops that are killed in Afghanistan, it generally is not by the Taliban. It is generally now by the young men and women who are, the U.S. are training in both the Afghan army and the national police, who turn their weapons on the people that are training them. And you ask, why do they turn their weapons on them? Well, if there was really an honest investigation of where these young men and women come from that are turning their weapons on U.S. military troops, I can guarantee you they come from that border area where the assassin drones, the U.S. assassin drones, are killing people every single day. And they are tired of it. They are fed up with the U.S. killing their own people. So let's keep in Afghanistan in our hearts and in our minds as the longest war that the U.S. has been involved in, 17 years. I was a part of reopening the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan in December of 2001, and I stayed there for about 5 months, never thinking that the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan would be more than a couple of years. In fact, our first team of U.S. diplomats that was there, we were sending back messages to Washington saying, there's probably a window of opportunity that the U.S. intervention or the invasion. At that time, it really wasn't an invasion because there weren't too many U.S. military that were there. But the presence of that military had forced the Taliban to back off. And there was an opportunity. I mean, here's the story, the U.S. version, U.S. government version of the story. And some of you all will probably go, well, that's a bunch of crap. I don't believe it. But as a diplomat at the time, what we were telling Washington, there will be a little window of opportunity that if the U.S. government wants to spend some funds to help reestablish schools for kids, you know, because the Taliban had closed all the schools, and young men could go to the madrasas, the religious schools, but women, girls couldn't go anywhere. So we said, if you can help reestablish some schools during this period, if you can help with some health clinics, if you can do a few roads, and then we need to get out of there, because we know the history of foreign involvement in Afghanistan. We know what's happened from, you know, centuries of other people invading Afghanistan. For whatever reason it is, it doesn't turn out well. Well, and so our assessment was 2 years, get out of there. Well, that didn't happen. 17 years later, there are some schools that are going from the U.S. support, but then you see what happens to these 60 young men and women who are trying just to take exams, that indeed the root causes of what was going on have not been addressed at all. And whether or not the current Afghan government will be able to address them in a way that means that there won't be the Taliban putting its reign of terror over women and children and men that don't agree with their outlook on life, whether that can happen, I don't know. But we do know that the U.S. presence there has not calmed anything, has not reduced the deaths, has not reduced the violence there. So I am certainly for continuing our press to for the end of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. Other parts of the world, since we're supposed to do kind of a sweep of the world on geopolitical issues, I think both Ray and I are, we can give you the rundown of what's going on in the world, but we also want to talk about what we as citizens can do to influence what's going on. Because it's one thing to sit in front of the TV and just about, you know, put a knife in your heart every day about what's going on. But what can we do to try to change things that are happening that you're seeing on TV? And I'll just mention two places in the world where citizen activism is strong, and whether or not we're having an influence, it's still up in the air whether we are. But for me personally, being involved in it, it gives me a little bit peace of mind that I'm trying to do something, and I'm active, trying my best, rather than not doing anything, which would drive me batshit crazy, pardon me. So in the urgency of now, what do? Do we sit there and go, oh, well, this is terrible? Or do we mobilize? And I mean, this is kind of crazy for you all. You've mobilized. You're here. I know most of you all, the ones that I know personally in the audience, and those of that I don't know, you're here for a reason. You have taken the time to say, I want to find out some more things that are going on and things that I can help with. So I think both Ray and I will probably give you some ideas on that. And the first one I want to talk about is has to do with the T-shirt that I have on, which is the 2018 Gaza Freedom Flotilla. Yay. And one of the things that Ray and I kind of, we agree on, never be seen in public without some writing on your shirt so that people will know, you know, something they can come up and start talking to you about. And it is amazing when you go into airports or wherever and you're standing around with a T-shirt. Generally, you know, back in the days when we had the T-shirt that said, arrest Bush or arrest Cheney first. I mean, sometimes you were wondering, especially if you go through the airports in Texas, down in Dallas and Houston, if you'd come out of those airports alive. But it was amazing, the people that would come up to you and say, why are you wearing that thing? Don't you like George Bush? And it was like, no, I don't like George Bush. I gave up my career in the government because I totally disagreed with George Bush. You know, it just opens up avenues for you to talk about. So when people come up and say, well, why do you have, what is this Gaza Freedom Flotilla thing? And then it opens up that you can say, well, I'm part of the international citizen activist movement, which is trying to educate people about what is going on in Palestine, in both the West Bank and in Gaza. I'm trying to talk to people about the fact that the Israeli government has a blockade on this little place called Gaza, 25 miles long, 5 miles wide, 2 million people in it, and there's a blockade around it, and they can't get in and out. They can't come to an airport like we're in right now. They're stuck unless the Israeli government lets them leave. And people are going, what? Where's Gaza? Yeah. Or talk about the West Bank, you know, where the Israeli government has illegal settlements in Palestinian lands. Now that the what was to be the state of Palestine the land that was given or allowed, the Palestinians allowed to keep in 1947 and 48 when the state of Israel was created out of the Palestine mandate, that has now been reduced to about 20%. And people go, what? They're stealing lands? I never heard that the Israeli government was stealing lands. And apartheid walls, no, those are just walls. Those are just walls. And well, where are the walls built? Well, Israel built them on their own land. Well, no, they didn't build them on their own land. They built them on Palestinian lands. And how about kids in prison? Did you know there were over, you know, between 600 and 900 kids that the Israelis had put in prison for throwing rocks? I said, what? I mean, throwing rocks? I mean, nobody should throw rocks at people, but you shouldn't go to prison for that, should you? I mean, so these sorts of things will open up the conversations that you can have with people. And for those of you all who have been great supporters of this crazy initiative called the Boats to Gaza or the Gaza Freedom Flotillas, you know, the flotillas started in 2008 when actually the Free Gaza movement, a good friend of ours, Greta Berlin, and others had this crazy idea that let's try to send some boats to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza. And they sent, in 2008, five little boats were actually able to get into Gaza. The first boats, international boats, coming into that little place, the one port the people of Gaza have in that area, in 40 years. In 40 years. That was the first time an international boat had come into that port. And it brought international, some of whom stayed for 6 months, and then they took out Palestinians who needed medical treatment but were unable to get it. Since then, since late 2008, the Israelis have blocked every attempt of the international community to try to break that blockade. They say, of course, that we are the terrorists, that we are terrorists for trying to challenge their blockade. So since 2008, we've had something like 30 boats that have been put on the high seas to bring attention to the fact that the Israelis still are blockading Gaza. You know, the World Health Organization says by the year 2020, the conditions in Gaza that are created by the Israeli government, by the lack of potable water, that the Israelis are taking water that should be flowing into Gaza, they're taking it, the lack of electricity, the sewage plant that is the first facility that is blown up by the Israelis, these conditions mean that by the year 2020, Gaza will become uninhabitable. Uninhabitable for 2 million people. So that's why we sail these boats, to bring attention. It's not attention to the boats, but it's attention as we talk to people throughout the voyage of these boats. Talk to people about the conditions in Gaza. And this year in 2018, we had four boats that started out from Scandinavia. Scandinavia and two boats went along the Atlantic coast of Europe through, well, let's see, where was it? Start in Denmark and then Germany. Then one boat went to England, another one down to Amsterdam, then across to Jersey, the island of Jersey, then into La Rochelle, France, then down Gijon, Spain, then Lisbon, Portugal, then around the Straits of Gibraltar, or Cadiz, on one side of the Straits of Gibraltar, I don't know. And then one boat had to divert to Algeria because one of the journalists on board had appendicitis. And then the other boats went on into Sardinia, then up to Corsica, then across to Naples, then down to Palermo on Sicily, and then on the 8 to 12 day voyage, depending on which boat you were on to 40 miles off Gaza, where the Israeli military stopped them. So those were two of our four boats. The other two boats, on the very first time we ever did this, we took boats through the center part of Europe, through the canals, rivers, and waterways of Central Europe, going in through Germany, then down through Belgium, then through France. And at every port, over 28 ports where these boats stopped, over 75 days of sailing, we had educational events to talk about what's going on in Gaza. So it was a remarkable, remarkable thing that people like you funded. We had 12 national campaigns, the U.S., Canada, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Spain, France, Italy, Malaysia. South Africa, New Zealand, Australia. We have national campaigns in each one of these. People like you in those countries help organize, help select delegates. The delegate from the United States on that final leg of it was Joe Metters, who is a USS Liberty survivor. Back in 1967, he was on the top deck of the USS Liberty as the Israeli military attempted to sink that ship, killing 34 people, wounding 174 people in 1967. So Joe has seen the violence of the Israeli military before. We also had on board Sui Ang, who is a orthopedic doctor who in 1982 had come to the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, in Beirut, Sabra and Shatila. And if you remember those camps, that's where Israeli-sponsored Christian militias, in a period of 3 days, killed over 3,500 Palestinians. So we had two people on board, and Dr. Sui was one of the surgeons that was in one of the hospitals in the camp of Sabra. She subsequently has founded the Medical Aid for Palestine. She has worked in hospitals in Gaza many times, right after one of the Israeli attacks. So we had two people on one of the boats that have seen up close and personal the Israeli violence. 22 people on one of the boats, 12 people on the second boat that actually made it to the point where we challenged the Israeli blockade of it. Those people were also met with violence. The captain of one of our ships was beaten up by the Israeli military. The engineer of that ship was beaten up. And three of the people, including Dr. Sui, who stands about 4 feet four and weighs maybe 80 pounds, was pushed around and had ribs broken. We had three people that were tasered by the Israeli military. All 34 of those people that were on the two boats are now out of Israeli prison, accosted on the high sea, in international waters, taken against your will to a place you do not want to go, Israel, interrogated, put into prison, deported, and they stole our ships. So these are the reasons why we as citizen activists are continuing to challenge the Israeli blockade. We know that many of you all are active in the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. Citizen activism all over the world that is putting such intense pressure on the Israeli government about their policies toward Palestinians that Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel has said that BDS is a strategic threat to the state of Israel. Yeah, that's it. Citizen activism doing that. It's so bad that right here in New York, your Israeli-lobbied legislature and governors have all put in law that it is a violation of New York law for corporations to participate in BDS. So that means we're succeeding. I mean, when the Israeli pressure on state governments, and there is a resolution in the U.S. Congress saying that if you support these types of things, that it's violating U.S. law. Well, we, of course, will be opposing that as citizens. But what it does, it shows very strongly, how the state of Israel influences U.S. politics. But it also shows how strong we as citizen activists can be. So continue to support these things. And, we support the young men and women of Palestine who are right now challenging the Israelis, whether it's on the Friday Great Return marches. Every Friday since late April, people have been going to the fence that is the delineation line with the border of Israel. And so far, the Israeli snipers sitting up on the tall berms that they've created, shooting down into crowds, have executed over 165 people and wounded over 16,000 people. And in the West Bank, we have the example of this young woman, 17-year-old now, 16 when she went into prison 8 months ago, Ahed Tamimi, who was put in prison for 8 months for slapping a soldier who was coming into their compound, and the reason she did it was because the Israeli soldiers had killed one of her cousins and had beaten up other people, and her mother and dad had already been imprisoned many times for challenging what the Israelis were doing in their village. So this young 16-year-old kid was put in jail for 8 months because she stood up to him and became a worldwide figure of challenging government oppression. And that's it. When we challenge government oppression, whether it's oppression of our own government on us here in the United States, or that we go to other places to challenge a U.S. ally using U.S. weapons, using U.S. money, the nearly $4 billion we give to Israel every single year, which is used to kill Palestinians. So we as citizen activists have a great role to play. I'll just finish up with another part of the world, though, where citizen activism is very important, and that's on peace in the Korean Peninsula. The only thing I will give President Trump credit for, because I don't agree with 99.9999999% of his policies, is his decision to talk with Kim Jong-un, the chairman of the leader of North Korea. That's something that we've been calling for. I'm part of a citizen activist group called Women Cross the DMZ. Women Cross the DMZ. In 2015, 30 of us, 30 women from 15 countries, including two Nobel Peace laureates, got permission from the North Koreans to come into North Korea and have a peace symposium with 250 North Korean women, and to hear their stories of why they want peace on their peninsula. And the reason they want it is for the last 65 years since the horrific, horrific Korean War that killed over 3 million Koreans in less than 3 years. It killed 38,000 U.S. people in 3 years. You know, how many Americans were killed on the U.S. war in Vietnam? 58,000. And how long was that? About 15 years when you really look at it. In a three-year period in Korea, 38,000 Americans were killed and 3 million Koreans. The policy of the United States during the Korean War was to level North Korea, to leave nothing standing. And that's documented in many, many, many books. So the North Korean women were telling us of the, you know, 65 years ago, this is what you all did to us, and we had to recover from it. And, you know, we haven't recovered because you keep putting pressure on us. You keep saying you're going to invade us. You're going to overthrow our government. So we're putting lots of money into our military so that you won't do that. In 2015, I don't even think they had exploded one nuclear weapon at that point. I think they started in 2016. But they were talking about a nuclear weapons program, and they said, what else can we do? We saw what you did to Iraq. We saw what you've done to Afghanistan. Nuclear weapons may be the way we protect ourselves. We had a peace march after the symposium. 5,000 women in Pyongyang came out to be a part of this peace march. I've never seen anything quite like it. And in Pyongyang, there is a giant boulevard that is like 12 lanes of traffic across. And over that boulevard is the huge statue that probably stands 100 feet in the air of two women leaning across holding hands. And it's called the Avenue of Reconciliation in Pyongyang. Now, I mean, does our media tell us anything about that? Does our media tell us that every single year the Korean government has been asking for a conference on a peace treaty? No. All we're told is those Koreans are going to invade South Korea. They're going to be a threat to the United States. I mean, it's generally countries that have a population of less than 30 million that become the targets of the United States. I mean, how many people live in North Korea? I think it's 28 million. And they're going to overwhelm the United States? Yet that's the rationale we've been given for 65 years, that we have kept the most stringent sanctions on any country in the world besides Iran on the people of North Korea. And granted, they've got horrible human rights problems. They have gulags. But the only way you get rid of those is if you don't have the pressure on the national government. That means that anybody that dissents that may say, maybe we shouldn't put as much money into our military. I think the human rights issues will sort themselves out if there is a peace treaty, so that they don't have to put so much attention on national security. And indeed, that's where citizen activism has come into play, although you don't read about it in the newspapers. But our little group of Women Cross the DMZ in Northeast Asia, that caused quite media blitz, that here you had 30 women from 15 countries in North Korea talking to North Korean women about a peace treaty, and then being allowed to cross the DMZ itself, only the third civilian group in the history of the DMZ being allowed to cross the DMZ, and then going into South Korea and have a peace conference with South Korean women, followed by a peace march in 2005 in South Korea along the DMZ, and then followed in 2016, 17, and 18 by peace marches along the DMZ. We will, if the Trump administration on the 1st of September does not reauthorize the special validation passport that you have to now have to get into North Korea, I can guarantee you by the end of the year we'll have another women's delegation that will be in North Korea, because it's important for us to go and see that. It's important for us to reach out. And granted, it is a state-controlled entity. We meet with only the people, only the women that the government of North Korea wants us to meet with, and that's fine. That's fine, because these are influential women, and they can carry the message back to the entities that they are a part of. I would encourage you all, if the special validation passport is dropped, that you have a delegation from right here to go to North Korea. You know, it's only America that isolates itself from North Korea. There are people from all countries that are going to North Korea because they don't have to have a permit from their national government. And we didn't need one until last year. You have to be careful, but it is important that we as Americans go see the places our government does not want us to see. It's our right to do it, and we have to do that. So, citizen activism. This women's group that went to North Korea was pilloried by the U.S. press. We were called naive, stupid, just women going, what are they doing? They're shills for the North Korean dictatorship. All of this sort of stuff. But I'll just tell you, that was during the Obama administration we did that. When the Trump administration came in, we, as we always do, make application to the NSC, the National Security Council. We would like to come talk to you about Afghanistan, Iraq, North Korea, about, you know, whatever group it is. We've all been parts of groups that have tried to get meetings with the National Security Council so that our views will be heard by senior leaders of the administration. To the credit of, not Trump, because he didn't even know this was going on, but to the guys that, and gals that he had appointed to be the Asia team in the National Security Council, and through a contact that I won't even mention, we were granted an appointment with the Asia National Security Council team. And we presented our list of things that we thought would be helpful to start a relationship with North Korea and to overcome the bias in the United States of all of the lobbyists that make money out of wars and make money out of supplying South Korea with all of its military equipment, to overcome their arguments. One was the humanitarian need to have contact on agricultural programs, which actually have been going on for 35 years. Did you know the Quakers have had agricultural programs in North Korea for 35 years? No. The Mennonites also have had agricultural projects. So we were saying, please don't stop those from happening, and in fact expand, let other organizations not be sanctioned, but have contact with the North Korean government so that some of these things can happen, so there can be an interchange. Until the Obama administration, we had North Korean farmers, agriculturists, that were coming to the United States, sponsored by AFSC, the American Friends Service Committee, and the Mennonites, that would come to our universities and look at agricultural things. It wasn't until all of these sanctions, big sanctions, started coming on that program was stopped. How about the return of human remains from the Korean War? I mean, that's just happened just this last week, but did you know that the North Korean government, through the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and the first part of the Trump administration, had said to them, if you just give us a letter saying that for humanitarian reasons you'd like to have these remains, over 200 boxes of them that the Koreans have, we'd be glad to give them back to you. Did you know that until the second administration of Obama, the United States had U.S. military in North Korea? Yeah, we had U.S. military in North Korea that were helping the North Koreans identify locations where U.S. aircraft had been shot down, had crashed, and we're doing joint recovery efforts of these remains. So there are things that we suggested that they do. There were other things on that list, and let me tell you, right now, every one of the recommendations that we have made have been implemented by the Trump administration. So I'm just saying that there are remarkable things that are happening, that things, because we as citizens take hold of some of these issues and demand to be heard. And sometimes we demand in very crazy ways, like sending boats 10,000 miles from Scandinavia all the way into 40 miles off Gaza to get publicity. In the U.S., I wouldn't say we've given up on the U.S. press, but we almost have. I mean, it's controlled by the state of Israel, essentially. We cannot get publicity for what the Israelis are doing to Palestinians, but the rest of the world covers these flotillas very remarkably. And thank God for social media, because that's where we inform you all, and you get the messages on Facebook and other things about what other citizens are doing. So I will end by just saying we encourage you all to pick an issue or pick several issues to become even more active on, because I know all of you all are active already. But if you want to be a part of any one of these things that we've already established and want to be a part of it, we would love to have your help on them. And whatever creative ideas you come up with on other aspects of our citizen involvement in foreign policy, international relations, which is our obligation to be involved in them, just let us know and we'd be glad to help. Thank you very much.
You're listening to episode 8 of Other Voices, Other Choices. We just heard from retired diplomat and Army Reserve Colonel Ann Wright. Next up is ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern. They spoke at the 20th annual Qatari Peace Conference held August 18th, 2018 in Fonda, New York.
I want to focus in on a couple of things, starting off from what Ann said. But maybe I'll start off with what I think needs to always be mentioned in such cases, and it pertains directly to Afghanistan and Iraq and Yemen and Libya and Africa. And it's maybe I best quote from Rudyard Kipling, who talked about the Christian white. Now, looks like that's us. It is not wise for the Christian white to hustle the Asian brown. For the Christian riles and the Asian smiles, and he weareth the Christian down. At the end of the fight lies a tombstone white with the name of the late deceased, and the epitaph drear, "A fool lies here who tried to hustle the East." Ann and I wrote a memorandum to, and our colleagues in Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, to President Obama in 2009, the title of which was, "Welcome to Vietnam, Mr. President." That's when he followed sheepishly the advice of his corrupt counselors, including military generals, to up the ante in Afghanistan. I mean, hello. Alexander the Great, I mean, he was the first one to find out that, you know, it makes no sense. He wanted to get to China, right? And he said, oh, there's a lot of riches and says, oh, he took his army. And then, they started taking real casualties on both flanks, had a council of war, Alexander the Great did. And he said, all right, generals, what do you think we should do? And they said, well, these people don't seem to appreciate us here. And look at those mountains there between us and China. We think we should kind of fold this operation, get the hell back to Central and Asia Minor where we know what the hell we're doing. And that's, my friends, why they call Alexander the Great, okay? He was great enough to figure out, this is a fool's errand. Let's get the hell out of here. Now, what happened after that? We have the Indians. We have the Pakistanis. We have the British. We have the French. We have the Americans. What are they trying to do in Afghanistan? The people still don't like people coming in. They won't learn that people coming in are just trying to help them. So That's how bad it is. Now, you wouldn't know that from the mainstream media. You wouldn't know, for example, that our Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, at the time, who was so good that Obama took him on, and he egged on with the help of the divine Petraeus and others, saying, yeah, we have to 20,000 more, 30,000 more, you know. And then, before he left office, addressing the West Point cadets, he said, now, with respect to Asia, I think that General MacArthur was right, I would counsel the president never to get involved in a land of war in Asia. Never, never, never. So there's a lot of cynicism here. There's a lot of hypocrisy. But the most important thing I'd like to leave with you, and of course Anne has already alluded to this, is what I call the MICOM. Now, you know that Ike referred to the military-industrial complex. Some of you even know that he wanted to say military-industrial congressional complex, but he was dissuaded. Ike, for God's sake, you know, military-industrial complex, that's going to blow up people's minds. Well, let's keep it. Well, now it's the military-industrial congressional intelligence media complex. Academic. Yeah, well, the MICOM was, yeah, okay. MICOM-A. Military-industrial congressional intelligence media academic complex. Man, it's all pervasive. And you have to recognize that to figure out what's going on. Now, what's the danger here? Well, the danger here is not only can people from Fort Drum or Camp Drum or whatever they call it come in here and say, Colonel Wright, sorry, you need to come with us now. And say, McGovern, you need to come with us too. How can they do that? That's all legal. They can do that. Habeas corpus? Yeah, that was 800 years ago, folks. That's obsolete. That's quaint. That's the Magna Carta. Come on, habeas corpus. They can come and seize us and put us in Guantanamo. I kid you not. Now, I don't want to exaggerate. Not forever. Okay, just until the end of the war on terrorism. So, let me just pick up on a couple of specifics here because we know, for example, that the CIA has been in the business of controlling the media, well, almost forever, but particularly since 1981, when Bill Casey, the head of the CIA, and I was on duty at the time, he appeared in Ronald Reagan's cabinet room with his cabinet colleagues, and Ronald Reagan was going around saying, what do you have to add? And what Bill Casey said is, quote, we'll know we've been successful when the American people believe everything we tell them, period, end quote. Now, how do I know that? A friend of mine, Barbara Honegger, was there. Did she take notes? She sure as hell did. Did she leak it? Yes, she leaked it. Did it appear in the Washington Press? Well, one afternoon, I think, in the Washington Star on page A18, okay? But now I think of Bill Casey. He's gone to his eternal, we have to be charitable here, reward. Okay, I used to say, he's looking down at us now. No, he may be looking up at us down here. Anyway, he's looking at us now. I say, man, was that successful? You know, did we try to make sure the Americans believe everything we want them to believe? You bet we did. Look at Russiagate, man, it's a terrific thing. Well, you know, now, what else is happening? Well, people are being thrown off Twitter. Peter Van Buren, a former Foreign Service officer, like Anne, has been thrown off Twitter. Others, Caitlin Johnstone, some of you know Caitlin Johnstone. She was thrown off Twitter, and there was such an outcry yesterday that she was put back on. KPFA, Pacifica, the first Pacifica, if I recall correctly. What did they do? They just canceled Guns and Butter, one of the most popular progressive radio shows. Randy Credico, banned from WBAL. Amy Goodman, people have said to me yesterday, oh, we see you on Amy Goodman. I said, when? One person said, oh, when you get beat up there in Congress. Well, folks, let me just tell you that the only time I get an Amy Goodman is if I get beat up in Congress. And the story, you know, can't be avoided. I'm not allowed on Amy Goodman anymore. because I say things she doesn't want to hear. I see things that hint that Hillary Clinton was quite capable of snatching defeat out of victory all by herself, and she didn't need the Russians to help her. That's anathema. That's anathema, not only in the mainstream press, but in the so-called progressive press. So, you know, I hate to tell you this, but this came to me this morning. Radio Pacifica has become Radio Acquiescica. That is bad. It would be ludicrous if it weren't so consequential, okay? But I've been reading stories, I always read stories that come to me in my from my friends and others. There's a senator in Florida who is accusing the Russians of already interfering in the election down there for this midterm election and trying to defeat him. And there's another public representative in California who is blaming the Russians for, what would you think?
The fires!
All right, you don't believe that? Look it up! And while I'm on the subject, where do you get your information? I go back to Fordham, where I graduated from, and I have all my colleagues there, some of us who are still looking at the grass from the top, you know? And they say, McGovern, where do you get this stuff? I say, what do you mean? Well, it's not in the New York Times. Now, I'm from the Bronx, right? My parents wouldn't go to sleep at night. They wouldn't go to sleep at night generally unless they had read the New York Times, as my Irish grandfather used to put it, black and white, okay? And if they dozed off before the TV, before they finished, they had a special place in the living room to put that day's Times, and they wouldn't dare touch the next day's Times until they had finished the first day's Times. That's how seriously the New York Times, and it was good. Man, it was, you know, not perfect, but there was most of the news that was fit to print. It ain't there now, folks, and what is there is so convoluted and so much intended to support the MICMA, the military-industrial congressional intelligence media academic complex, that you can't recognize what's really going on. What else? Okay, last thing. A very brave delegate for Bernie, in northern, where are we, New York now? Yeah, sometimes we're in Gaza or something. Yeah, okay, we're in New York. Told me a story. She said that she voted for Bernie, and then after the election, she was told by a Democratic, Gauleiter, what was it, sort of a precinct manager or whatever. You know, your name came up recently, in our discussions, and it was recommended. You were quite a good organizer, but, well, let me just ask you, have you ever been approached by the Russians? It's sick, folks. It's very, very sick. And it wouldn't be so bad if it weren't so damn consequential. I have watched the Soviet Union and Russia since I majored in Russian, starting in 1959 at Fordham, okay? 27 years in government service, in academe, and so forth. The Soviet Union fell apart in 1990, 1991. Did you guys know that? They're not trying to take over the world anymore. Honest, take it from me. Where's the evidence? Well, the evidence is conjured up in the New York Times and elsewhere. So, why is it so consequential? How many of you have read The Doomsday Machine by my friend Daniel Ellsberg? Raise your hands. Okay. Scary? What I take away from it is that it is, I believe in miracles, okay? This is a surefire miracle that we're around here today, that we came so close on several occasions in the past to incinerating this planet. It's a miracle, okay? And Dan proves it, and I know of a couple of other incidents from inside the government where we're even closer than Dan explains in his examples. And so that's a miracle. Now, do miracles happen all the time or last forever? I don't think so. And so there's no percentage, folks, in cultivating animosity toward Russia, which can blow us up or can start or reply to military activity. So that's why it's so consequential. When there's no need. Now, Ann said that she doesn't agree with Trump. 99.999, did I get it? Is all the nines? Yeah. Well, I add a nine to that, okay? And my wife always tells me, Ray, for God's sake, tell them what you think of Trump. He is antithetical to everything I believe in my faith journey, in what I think our country should be. But even a broken clock is right. How many times a day? Twice a day, all right. He's right on Korea, and he's right on Russia. For God's sake, there's no reason in this God's earth why there can't be a more decent relationship with Russia. If we stop pouring our armies onto their western border, if we stop creating new, quote, allies, end quote, in places like Montenegro, in places where who needs a new ally, right? Moving NATO ever, ever eastward. It doesn't make any sense, folks, except for the people who are profiteering on the war. And those people, you know, I don't agree with everything Pope Francis says. I like him a lot compared to his predecessors. But he was right on this one. 2 years ago, he was up before Congress, September. 2 years ago, and he said, you know, the main problem, get this, folks, Francis, the main problem is the blood-drenched arms traders. And what do those congressmen do? They're all up there. Yeah. Oh, clap, 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 clap. It was almost like Netanyahu said it, you know? I mean, they were really, okay. And then I watched them as they looked into their vest pocket to see if the latest envelope from Lockheed was there and the one from Raytheon was there. I mean, it was giving hypocrisy a bad name, for God's sake. So that's the key, the Mikama. What else? Well, where do you go for accurate news? Well, the first place to look is raymcgovern.com. Now, you know, that's funny, right? That's self-serving. But I pour my life's blood into that damn thing. And people come up to me and say, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And I try as gently as I can say, well, last week I wrote about that. Could you please just click on raymcgovern.com? My son set that thing up for me. He populates it. It puts things up within an hour. And, you know, with all due respect, please consider clicking on to raymcgovern.com. Consortiumnews.com, which covers many more issues than the things that I just cover, is another. You wouldn't believe the dialogue that happens when I write, or when Ann writes, or somebody writes an article on consortiumnews.com. Sometimes 400 comments, and some of them I learn a lot of stuff from, because these are very knowledgeable people. It's unique in that respect. What else? Well, the Information Clearinghouse. Now, what is that? It's a compendium of articles that are written in the last day or two. And it's so inclusive that if you want to be informed, you look through that, you click on what you want to see, and you won't miss much, okay? So those things I would really recommend. Then the last thing is simply Stephen F. Cohen. Now, Stephen F. Cohen is the best professor of Russian and Soviet history that I've ever come across, and as you know, it's my field. He's been around, and he really, really knows his stuff. And to his credit, he could have gone off into retirement, but ever since the Ukrainian crisis, so to speak, he has been pointing out that to the degree the Russians have reacted aggressively, it's simply because we mounted a coup on their doorstep in Kiev in 2014, and everything they've done since, including Crimea, has been a reaction to their wish not to have NATO in the same country through which Napoleon, Hitler, and others have come to kill Russians. Now, how many people perished in Russia in World War II? Anybody know? Yeah, 26 million is what Putin says. Historians say 27 million. Can you imagine how many Americans died in World War II? Well, soldiers, about 460,000. Do the math, folks. The Russians know about war. We don't. We're sort of capricious. We're sort of John Bolton-ish. Oh, well, let's have a war, you know? So that's the consequential part of this. Let me see if I can wrap up here. Yeah, I think, as Anne hinted, I think our job is to expose what's going on and find ways to do that. Now, that's a tall order. Dr. King, in that same, well, in the letter from the Birmingham City Jail, talked about a boil. He said, like a boil that can never be cured unless it's opened up with all this pus-flowing ugliness to the natural medicines of air and light. So true, injustice must be uncovered with all the friction its uncovering creates to the light of human conscience and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. Now, it's getting pretty late, folks. And what I'd like to do is just finish up. I mean, the fierce urgency of the now, finish up with a little story out of Nazi Germany, because we're getting close, folks. We're getting very close to Nazi Germany in terms of fascism. And I use the word advisedly. Look it up. So, most of you know about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Protestant minister who was stood up to the Nazis, one of the very few. That's one of my great sorrows, of course, that the Lutheran and the Catholic Church during Nazi Germany couldn't find its voice, and that's another story. But anyhow, along with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, there was a fellow named Albrecht Haushofer. He was a Geolog at the University of Berlin. That means he was a professor of geology, and he had tenure. Now, anybody here know what tenure means? And how did he get tenure? By keeping his mouth shut, right? Well, it's Jewish and it's Gypsy, and other people get carted away. So finally, he also had a conscience. He had a conscience, and so he started to speak out against Hitler. Gathered a rather sizable group around him, and opposed the threat. So they wrapped him up, put him in a different prison from Bonhoeffer. And now the Nazis, of course, were very Germanic and very orderly, and so they had a process. They wouldn't shoot you, as they did in Haushofer's prison. They wouldn't hang you, as they did to Bonhoeffer, without you writing a confession, right? So Haushofer says that's for the birds. I mean, I'm not going to write a confession. As the Allies approached, they shot him anyway, okay? So as they picked him up from the floor, after they shot him, out of his pocket fell a little zettel, a little piece of paper. And on it, he had written his confession. And those of you who know some German will maybe help me here. It's very brief. I'll read it and I'll translate it. The title was Schuld. Schuld? Guilt. Doch bin ich schuldig, aber anders als ihr denkt. Yeah, I'm guilty, but it's not what you're thinking. Ich musste früher meine Pflicht erkennen. Ich musste schärfer Unheil nennen. I should have earlier recognized my duty. I should have more sharply, schärfer, called evil, evil. Mein Urteil habe ich zu lang gelenkt. My judgment I put off too long. Ich habe gewarnt. I did warn, and he did warn. Aber nicht genug und klar. Genug? Enough. Ich habe gewarnt, aber nicht genug und klar. Klar is clear. Claro, there's no comparative for the adjective in Germany, klar ist klar. Ich habe gewarnt, aber nicht genug und klar. Und heute weiß ich, was ich schuldig war. And today I recognize what I was guilty of. So, folks, as I look at it, you, almost without exception, you have a big, big advantage that most Americans don't have. And that is what Joan Chittister calls the gift of age. What I call the gift of this color hair, okay? Suffice it to say that what we all share in all the disparate justice activities we're all already engaged in is one quality, and that is that we are all pretty much older people that young people can look up to if we do what we should do now in the urgency of the moment. Now, what does that mean? Well, you got to piece that together by yourself. I'm not going to tell you. You're not going to do it by yourself. You need a small group to decide what to do. But if it includes putting your body into it, what will that mean? Well, I know from personal experience, when I got creamed by the George Washington University police just for standing up and turning my back to Hillary Clinton, there were all kinds of emails, all kinds of telephone calls to Hillary Clinton. Why? Why? Thousands of them. Why? Well, because American people are pretty discriminating. Young people, they have it coming to them. Yeah, they're going to get in trouble. Yeah, they get beat up. Yeah, young people. Old people, not so much, folks. Americans don't like old people to get beat up. So be advised. They're not going to kill you. They're not going to even dislocate your shoulder if there's a friendly iPhone person right next to you. Do it. Put your body into it. And then maybe young people can look up to us and say, my God, these guys take this seriously. Maybe they've seen this before. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to episode 8 of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. This episode features talks by Anne Wright and Ray McGovern, recorded at the 20th Annual Kateri Peace Conference, held August 18, 2018, in Fonda, New York. Anne Wright is a retired diplomat and Army Reserve colonel who resigned from the Department of State in 2003 in opposition to the Iraq War. Ray McGovern served as a CIA analyst for 27 years, from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. In January 2003, Ray co-founded Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose how intelligence was being falsified to provide a pretext for war on Iraq. You can find Other Voices, Other Choices on iTunes and YouTube. Thanks for listening.